a time tick. But at crudest level, minimum would be octant, tables, and good watch. Our visitors were even encouraged to go out on surface, but if one had carried an octant or modern equivalent, might have had an accident. We did not make accidents for spies. We let them stay, worked them hard, and Mike read their reports. One reported that he was certain that we had found uranium ore, something unknown in Luna at that time. Project Centerbor, being many years later. Next spy came out with kit of radiation counters. We made it easy for him to sneak them through Bor. By March 76, Catapult was almost ready, lacking only installation of stator segments. Power plant was in, and a coax had been strung underground with a line-of-sight link for that 30 kilometers. Crew was down to skeleton size, mostly party members, but we kept one spy so that Alvarez could have regular reports.
Didn't want him to worry.
It tended to make him suspicious. Instead, we worried him in Warrens. 10. Were changes in those 11 months? Lyle was baptized into Greg's church. Prof's health became so shaky that he dropped teaching. Mike took up writing poetry. Yankees finished in cellar. Wouldn't have mind paying Prof if they had been nosed out.
But from pennant to cellar in one season, ugh. I quit watching them on video. Prof's illness was phony. He was in perfect shape for age, exercising in hotel room 3 hours each day and sleeping in 300 kilograms of lead pajamas.
And so was I, and so was Wyo, who hated it. I don't think she ever cheated and spent night in comfort, though can't say for sure. I was not dossing with her. She had become a fixture in Davis' family. Took her one day to go from Gospodja Davis to Gospodja Mum. One more to reach Mum, and now it might be Mimi Mum with arm around Mum's waist. When zebra files showed she couldn't go back to Hong Kong, Sidrus had taken Wyo into her beauty shop after hours and done a job which left skin same dark shade but would not scrub off. Sidrus also did a hairdo on Wyo that left it black and looked as if unsuccessfully unkinked. Plus minor touches, opaque nail enamel, plastic inserts for cheeks and nostrils, and of course she wore her dark-eyed contact lenses. When Sidrus got through, Wyo could have gone bundling without fretting about her disguise. Was a perfect colored with ancestry to match. Tamil, a touch of Angola, German. I called her Wyma rather than Wyo. She was gorgeous. When she undulated down a corridor, boys followed in swarms. She started to learn farming from Greg, but Mom put a stop to that. While she was big and smart and willing, our farm is mostly a male operation, and Greg and Hans were not only male members of our family distracted. She cost more farming man-hours than her industry equaled. So, Wyo went back to housework. Then Sidrus took her into beauty shop as helper. Prof played ponies with two accounts, betting one by Mike's leading apprentice system, other by his own scientific system. By July 75, he admitted that he knew nothing about horses and went solely to Mike's system, increasing bets and spreading them among many bookies. His winnings paid party's expenses, while Mike built swindle that financed Catapult. But Prof lost interest in a sure thing, and merely placed bets as Mike designated. He stopped reading pony journals. Sad. Something dies when an old horse player quits. Ludmilla had a girl, which they say is lucky in a first, and which delighted me.
Every family needs a girl baby.
Lyle surprised our women by being expert in midwifery, and surprised them again that she knew nothing about baby care. Our two oldest sons found marriages at last, and Teddy, 13, was opted out. Greg hired two lads from neighbor farms, and after 6 months of working and eating with us, both were opted in. Not rushing things. We had known them and their families for years. It restored balance we had lacked since Ludmilla's opting, and put stop to snide remarks of mothers of bachelors who had not found marriages. Not that Mum wasn't capable of snubbing anyone she did not consider up to Davis standards. Wyo recruited Sidrus. Sidrus started on sale by recruiting her other assistant, and Bonton Beauté Shop became hotbed of subversion. We started using our smallest kids for deliveries, another job zone a child can do. They can stake out or trail a person through corridors better than an adult, and are not suspected. Sidrus grabbed this notion and expanded it through women recruited in beauty parlor. Soon she had so many kids on tap that we could keep all of Alvarez's spies under surveillance. With Mike able to listen at any phone, and a child spotting it whenever a spy left home or place of work or wherever, with enough kids on call so that one could phone while another held down a new stakeout, we could keep a spy under tight observation and keep him from seeing anything we didn't want him to see. Shortly, we were getting reports spies phoned in without waiting for zebra file. It did a sod no good to phone from a tap room instead of home. With Baker Street irregulars on job, Mike was listening before he finished punching number. These kids located Alvarez's deputy spy boss in El City. We knew he had one because these finks did not report to Alvarez by phone. Nor did it seem possible that Alvarez could have recruited them, as none of them worked in complex. And Alvarez came inside Luna City only when an Earthside VIP was so important as to raid a bodyguard commanded by Alvarez in person. His deputy turned out to be two people, an old lag who ran a candy, news, and booking counter in Old Dome, and his son, who was on civil service in complex.
Some carried reports in, so Mike had not been able to hear them.
We let them alone. But from then on, we had Fink field reports half a day sooner than Alvarez. This advantage, all due to kids as young as 5 or 6, saved lives of 7 comrades. All glory to Baker Street irregulars. Don't remember who named them, but I think it was Mike. I was merely a Sherlock Holmes fan, whereas he really did think he was Sherlock Holmes' brother Mycroft. Nor would I swear he was not. Reality is a slippery notion. Kids did not call themselves that. They had their own play gangs with own names. Nor were they burdened with secrets which could endanger them. Sidrus left to mothers to explain why they were being asked to do these jobs, save that they were never to be told the real reason. Kids will do anything mysterious and fun. Look how many of their games are based on outsmarting. Bon Ton Salon was a clearinghouse of gossip. Women get news faster than Daily Lunatic. I encouraged Wyo to report to Mike each night, not try to thin gossip down to what seemed significant, because no telling what might be significant once Mike got through associating it with a million other facts. Beauty parlor was also a place to start rumors. Party had grown slowly at first, then rapidly, as powers of three began to be felt, and also because peace dragoons were nastier than old bodyguard. As numbers increased, we shifted to high speed on agitprop. Black propaganda rumors, open subversion, provocateur activities, and sabotage. Finn Nielsen handled agitprop when it was simpler, as well as dangerous job of continuing to front for and put cover-up activity into older, spy-ridden underground. But now a large chunk of agitprop and related work was given to Sidrus. Much involved distributing handbills and such. No subversive literature was ever in her shop, nor our home, nor that hotel room. Distribution was done by kids, too young to read. Sidrus was also working a full day, bending hair and such. About time she began to have too much to do, I happened one evening to make walkabout on causeway with Sidrus on my arm when I caught sight of a familiar face and figure. Skinny little girl, all angles, carrot red hair. She was possibly 12, at stage when a femme shoots up just before blossoming out into rounded softness. I knew her, but could not say why or when or where. I said, "Psst, baby doll, eyeball young femme ahead. Orange hair, no cushions." Sidrus looked her over. "Darling, I knew you were eccentric, but she's still a boy." "Damp it."
"Who?"
"Bog knows. Shall I sprag her?" Suddenly I remembered like video coming on, and wished Wyo were with me. But Wyo and I were never together in public. This skinny redhead had been at meeting where Shorty was killed. She sat on floor against wall, down front, and listened with wide-eyed seriousness, and applauded fiercely. Then I had seen her at end in free trajectory, curled into ball in air, and hit a yellow jacket in knees, he whose jaw I broke a moment later. Wyo and I were alive and free because this kid moved fast in a crisis. "No, don't speak to her," I told Sidrus. "But I want to keep her in sight. Wish we had one of your irregulars here. Damn."
"Drop off and phone Wyo. You'll have one in 5 minutes,"
my wife said. I did. Then Sidrus and I strolled, looking in shop windows and moving slowly, as Quarry was window shopping. In 7 or 8 minutes, a small boy came toward us, stopped and said,
"Hello, Auntie Mabel. Hi, Uncle Joe."
Sidrus took his hand.
"Hi, Tony. How's your mother, dear?"
"Just fine," he added in a whisper.
"I'm Jock."
"Sorry."
Sidrus said quietly to me,
"Stay on her,"
and took Jack into a tuck shop. She came out and joined me. Jock followed her, licking a lollipop.
"Bye, Auntie Mabel. Thanks."
He danced away, rotating, wound up by that little redhead, stood and stared into a display, solemnly sucking his sweet. Sidrus and I went home. A report was waiting.
"She went into Cradle Row Crash and hasn't come out. Do we stay on it?"
"A bit yet," I told Wyo, and asked if she remembered this kid. She did, but had no idea who she might be.
"You could ask Finn."
"Can do better," I called Mike. Yes, Cradle Row Crash had a phone, and Mike would listen. Took him 20 minutes to pick up enough to get analysis. Many young voices, and at such ages, almost sexless. But presently, he told me, "Man, I hear 3 voices that could match the age and physical type you described. However, 2 answer to names which I assume to be masculine. The 3rd answer is when anyone says Hazel, which an older female voice does repeatedly. She seems to be Hazel's boss." "Mike, look at old organization file. Check Hazel's." 4 Hazels," he answered at once. "And here she is. Hazel Mead, Young Comrades Auxiliary. Address, Cradle Row Crash. Born 25 December, 2063. Mass, 39 kilos. Height..." "That's our little jump jet. Thanks, Mike. Wyo, call off stakeout. Good job."
"Mike, call Donna and pass the word. That's a dear."
I left it to girls to recruit Hazel Mead and did not eyeball her until Sidrus moved her into our household 2 weeks later. But Wyo volunteered a report before then. Policy was involved. Sidrus had filled her cell but wanted Hazel Mead. Besides this irregularity, Sidrus was doubtful about recruiting a child. Policy was adults only, 16 and up. I took it to Adam Celine, an executive cell. "As I see," they said, "this sales of 3 system is to serve us, not bind us. See nothing wrong in Comrade Cecilia having an extra, nor any real danger to security."
"I agree," said Prof. "But I suggest that the extra member not be part of Cecilia's cell. She should not know the others. I mean, unless the duties Cecilia gives her make it necessary. Nor do I think she should recruit at her age. The real question is her age."
"Agreed," said Wyo. "I want to talk about this kid's age."
"Friends," Mike said diffidently. Diffidently first time in weeks. He was now that confident executive Adam Celine, much more than lonely machine. "Perhaps I should have told you, but I have already granted similar variations. It did not seem to require discussion."
"It doesn't, Mike," Prof reassured him.
"A chairman must use his own judgment.
What is our largest cell?"
5. It is a double cell, 3 and 2.
No harm done. Dear Wyo, does Sidrus propose to make this child a full comrade? Let her know that we are committed to revolution, with all the bloodshed, disorder, and possible disaster that entails. That's exactly what she is requesting. But dear lady, while we are staking our lives, we are old enough to know it. For that, one should have an emotional grasp of death. Children seldom are able to realize that death will come to them personally. One might define adulthood as the age at which a person learns that he must die, and accepts this sentence undismayed.
Prof, I said, I know some mighty tall children. 7 to 2, some are in party.
No bet, Copper. I'll give odds that at least half of them don't qualify, and we might find out the hard way at the end of this, our folly.
Prof, Wyo insisted.
Mike, Manny, Sidrus is certain this child is an adult, and I think so too.
Man? Asked Mike. Let's find a way for Prof to meet her and form an opinion. I was taken by her, especially her go-to-hell fighting, or would never have started it.
We adjourned, and I heard no more. Hazel showed up at a dinner shortly thereafter as Sidrus' guest. She showed no signs of recognizing me, nor did I admit that I had ever seen her, but learned long after that she had recognized me, not just by left arm, but because I had been hatted and kissed by tall blonde from Hong Kong. Furthermore, Hazel had seen through Wyoming's disguise, recognized what Wyo never did successfully disguise, her voice. But Hazel used lip glue. If she ever assumed I was in conspiracy, she never showed it.
Child's history explained her,
far as background can explain steely character.
Transported with parents as a baby, much as Wyo had been, she had lost her father through accident while he was convict labor, which mother blamed on indifference of authority to safety of penal colonists. Her mother lasted till Hazel was 5. What she died from, Hazel did not know. She was then living in creche where we found her. Nor did she know why parents had been shipped, possibly for subversion, if they were both under sentence, as Hazel thought. As may be, her mother left her a fierce hatred of authority and warden. Family that ran cradle roll let her stay. Hazel was pinning diapers and washing dishes as soon as she could reach. She had taught herself to read, and could print letters, but could not write. Her knowledge of math was only that ability to count money that children soak up through their skins. Was fuss over her leaving creche. Owner and husbands claimed Hazel owed several years' service. Hazel solved it by walking out, leaving her clothes and fewer belongings behind. Mom was angry enough to want family to start trouble, which could wind up in brawling she despised. But I told her privately that, as her cell leader, I did not want our family in public eye, and hauled out cash, and told her party would pay for clothes for Hazel. Mom refused money, called off a family meeting, took Hazel into town, and was extravagant, for Mom, in re-outfitting her. So, we adopted Hazel. I understand that these days adopting a child involves red tape. In those days, it was as simple as adopting a kitten. Was more fuss when Mom started to place Hazel in school, which fitted neither what Sidrus had in mind, nor what Hazel had been led to expect as a party member and comrade. Again, I butted in, and Mom gave in partway. Hazel was placed in a tutoring school close to Sidra's shop, that is, near easement Lock 13. Beauty parlor was by it. Sidrus had good business, because close enough that our water was piped in and used without limit as return line took it back for salvage. Hazel studied mornings and helped in afternoons, pinning on gowns, handing out towels, giving rinses, learning trade, and whatever else Sidrus wanted. Whatever else was captain of Baker Street Irregulars. Hazel had handled younger kids all her short life. They liked her. She could wheedle them into anything. She understood what they said when an adult would find it gibberish. She was a perfect bridge between party and most junior auxiliary. She could make a game of chores be assigned and persuade them to play by rules she gave them,
and never let them know it was adult serious, but child serious, which is another matter. For example, let's say a little one, too young to read, is caught with a stack of subversive literature, which happened more than once. Here's how it would go, after Hazel indoctrinated the kid.
Baby, where'd you get this?
I'm not a baby. I'm a big boy.
Okay, big boy. Where did you get this?
Jackie give it to me.
Who is Jackie?
Jackie.
But what's his last name?
Who?
Jackie.
Jackie's a girl.
All right. Where does she live?
Who?
And so on around. To all questions, key answer was of pattern. Jackie give it to me. Since Jackie didn't exist, he, she, didn't have a last name, a home address, nor fixed sex. Those children enjoyed making fools of adults, once they learned how easy it was. At worst, literature was confiscated. Even a squad of peace dragoons thought twice before trying to arrest a small child. Yes, we were beginning to have squads of dragoons inside Luna City, but never less than a squad. Some had gone in singly, and not come back. When Mike started writing poetry, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. He wanted to publish it. Shows how thoroughly humanity had corrupted this innocent machine that he should wish to see his name in print. I said, Mike, for Bug's sake, blown all circuits or planning to give us away? Before he could sulk, Prof said, Hold on, Manuel. I see possibilities. Mike, would it suit you to take a pen name? That's how Simon Jester was born. Mike picked it apparently by tossing random numbers, but he used another name for serious verse, his party name, Adam Celine. Simon's verse was doggerel, bawdy, subversive, ranging from poking fun at vips to savage attacks on Warden, System, Peace Dragoons, Finks. You found it on walls of public WCs, or on scraps of paper left in tube capsules, or in tap rooms. Wherever they were signed Simon Jester, and with a matchstick drawing of a little horned devil with big grin and forked tail. Sometimes he was stabbing a fat man with a pitchfork. Sometimes just his face would appear, big grin and horns, until, shortly, even horns and grin meant Simon was here. Simon appeared all over Luna same day, and from then on never let up. Shortly he started receiving volunteer help. His verses and little pictures, so simple anybody could draw them, began appearing more places than we had planned. This wider coverage had to be from fellow travelers. Verses and cartoons started appearing inside Complex, which could not have been our work. We never recruited civil servants. Also, 3 days after initial appearance of a very rough limerick, one that implied that Warden's fatness derived from unsavory habits, this limerick popped up on pressure sticky labels, with cartoon improved so that fat victim flinching from Simon's pitchfork was recognizably Mort the Wart. We didn't buy them. We didn't print them. But they appeared in El City, and Novelin, and Hong Kong, stuck almost everywhere. Public phones, stanchions and corridors, pressure locks, ramp railings, other. I had a sample count made, fed it to Mike. He reported that over 70,000 labels had been used in El City alone. I did not know of a printing plant in El City willing to risk such a job and equipped for it. Began to wonder if might be another revolutionary cabal. Simon's verses were such a success that he branched out as a poltergeist, and neither Warden nor security chief was allowed to miss it. Dear Mort the Wart, ran one letter. Do please be careful from midnight to 400 tomorrow. Love and kisses, Simon. With horns and grin. In same mail, Alvarez received one reading. Dear Pimplehead, if the Warden breaks his leg tomorrow night, it will be your fault. Faithfully your conscience, Simon. Again with horns and smile. We didn't have anything planned. We just wanted Mort and Alvarez to lose sleep, which they did, plus bodyguard.
All Mike did was to call Warden's private phone at intervals from midnight to 400.
An enlisted number supposedly known only to his personal staff. By calling members of his personal staff simultaneously and connecting them to Mort, Mike not only created confusion, but got Warden angry at his assistants. He flatly refused to believe their denials. But was luck that Warden, goaded too far, ran down a ramp.
Huh.
Even a new chum does that only once. So he walked on air and sprained an ankle, close enough to a broken leg, and Alvarez was there when it happened. Those sleep losers were mostly just that. Like rumor that Authority Catapult had been mined and would be blown up another night. 90 plus 18 men can't search 100 kilometers of catapult in hours, especially when 90 are peace dragoons, not used to peacesuit work and hating it. This midnight came at New Earth with sun high. They were outside far longer than is healthy, managed to cook up their own accidents while almost cooking themselves, and showed nearest thing to mutiny in regiment's history. One accident was fatal. Did he fall, or was he pushed? A sergeant. Midnight alarms made peace dragoons on passport watch, much taken by yawning and more bad-tempered, which produced more clashes with loonies and still greater resentment both ways. So Simon increased pressure. Adam Celine's verse was on a higher plane. Mike submitted it to Prof and accepted his literary judgment. Good, I think, without resentment.
Mike's scansion and rhyming were perfect. Mike being a computer with whole English language in his memory, and able to search for a fitting word in microseconds.
What was weak was self-criticism. That improved rapidly under Proof's stern editorship. Adam Celine's byline appeared first in dignified pages of Munglo, over a somber poem titled Home. Was dying thoughts of old transportee. His discovery as he is about to leave that Luna is his beloved home. Language was simple. Rhyme scheme unforced. Only thing faintly subversive was conclusion on part of dying man that even many wardens he has endured was not too high a price. Doubt if Munglo's editors thought twice. Was good stuff. They published. Alvarez turned editorial office inside out, trying to get the line back to Adam Celine. Issue had been on sale half a lunar before Alvarez noticed it. Or had it called to his attention. We were fretted. We wanted that byline noticed. We were much pleased with the way Alvarez oscillated when he did see it. Editors were unable to help Fink Boss. They told him truth. Poem had come in by nail. Did they have it? Yes, surely. Sorry, no envelope. They were never saved. After a long time, Alvarez left, flanked by 4 dragoons he had fetched along for his health. Hope they enjoyed studying that sheet of paper. Was piece of Adam Celine's business stationery. Celine Associates, Luna City, Investments, Office of the Chairman, Old Dome. And under that was typed, Home, by Adam Celine, etc. Any fingerprints were added after it left us. Had been typed on Underwood office electrostator. Commonest model in Luna. Even so, were not too many as are importado. A scientific detective could have identified machine, would have found it in Luna City office of Luna Authority. Machines, should say, as we found 6 of model in office and used them in rotation. 5 words and move to next. Cost Wyo and self sleep, but too much risk even though Mike listened at every phone, ready to warn. Never did it that way again. Alvarez was not a scientific detective. 11. In early 76, I had too much to do. Could not neglect customers. Party work took more time even though all possible was delegated. But decisions had to be made on endless things, and messages passed up and down. Had to squeeze in hours of heavy exercise, wearing weights, and doesn't arrange permission to use centrifuge at Complex, one used by earthworm scientists to stretch time in Luna. While had used it before, this time could not advertise that I was getting in shape for Earthside. Exercising without centrifuge is less efficient and was especially boring because did not know there would be need for it. But according to Mike, 30% of ways events could fall required some loony, able to speak for party, to make trip to Terra. Could not see myself as an ambassador. Don't have education, and not diplomatic. Prof was obvious choice of those recruited, or likely to be. But Prof was old, might not live to land Earthside. Mike told us that a man of Prof's age, body type, etc., had less than 40% chance of reaching Terra alive. But Prof did gaily undertake strenuous training to let him make most of his poor chances. So what could I do but put on weights and get to work, ready to go and take his place if old Hart clicked off? Wyo did same, on assumption that something might keep me from going. She did it to share misery. Wyo always used gallantry in place of logic. On top of business, party work and exercise, was farming. We had lost 3 sons by marriage while gaining 2 fine lads, Frank and Ali. Then Greg went to work for Luno Hoko, as boss drillman on New Catapult. Was needful. Much skull sweat went into hiring construction crew. We could use non-party men for most jobs, but key spots had to be party men as competent as they were politically reliable. Greg did not want to go. Our farm needed him, and he did not like to leave his congregation, but accepted. That made me again a valet, part-time, to pigs and chickens. Hans is a good farmer, picked up load and worked enough for 2 men. But Greg had been farm manager ever since Grandpa retired. New responsibility worried Hans. Should have been mine, being senior, but Hans was better farmer and closer to it. Always been expected he would succeed Greg someday. So, I backed him up by agreeing with his opinions and tried to be half a farmhand in hours I could squeeze. Left no time to scratch. Late in February, I was returning from long trip. Novaline, Takawonder, Churchill. New tube had just been completed across Sinus Medii, so I went on to Hong Kong in Luna. Business, and did make contacts now that I could promise emergency service. Fact that Endville below the Hatchy bus ran only during dark semi-lunar had made impossible before. But business was cover for politics. Liaison with Hong Kong had been thin. Wyo had done well by phone. Second member of her cell was an old comrade. Comrade Clayton, who not only had clean bill of health in Alvarez's file Zebra, but also stood high in Wyo's estimation. Clayton was briefed on policies, warned of bad apples, encouraged to start cell system while leaving old organization untouched. Wyo told him to keep his membership as before. But phone isn't face-to-face. Hong Kong should have been our stronghold. Was less tied to authority, as its utilities were not controlled from complex. Was less dependent because lack, until recently, of tube transport, had made sailing at Catapult Head less inviting. Was stronger financially as Bank of Hong Kong Luna notes were better money than official authority scrip. I suppose Hong Kong dollars weren't money in some legal sense. Authority would not accept them. Times I went Earthside had to buy authority scrip to pay for ticket. But what I carried was Hong Kong dollars, as could be traded Earthside at a small discount, whereas scrip was nearly worthless there. Money or not, Hong Kong banknotes were backed by honest Chinese bankers instead of being fiat of bureaucracy. 100 Hong Kong dollars was 31.1 grams of gold, old troy ounce, payable on demand at home office. And they did keep gold there, fetched up from Australia. Or you could demand commodities, non-potable water, steel of defined grade, heavy water of power plant specs, other things. Could buy these with scrip too, but authorities' prices kept changing. Upward. I'm no fiscal theorist. Time Mike tried to explain, I got headache. Simply know we were glad to lay hands on this non-money, whereas scrip one accepted reluctantly, and not just because we hated authority.
Hong Kong should have been party stronghold, but was not. We had decided that I should risk face-to-face there, letting some know my identity, as a man with one arm can't disguise easily. Was risk that would jeopardize not only me, but could lead to Wyo, Mum, Greg, and Sidrus if I took a fall. But who said revolution was safe? Comrade Clayton turned out to be young Japanese. Not too young, but they all look young, till suddenly look old. He was not all Japanese, Malay and other things, but had Japanese name, and household had Japanese manners. Giri and Gimu controlled, and it was my good fortune that he owned much Gimu to Wyo. Clayton was not convict ancestry. His people had been volunteers marched aboard ship at gunpoint during time Great China consolidated Earthside Empire. I did not hold it against him. He hated Warden as bitterly as any old lag. Met him first at a tea house. Tap room to us El City types. And for 2 hours we talked everything but politics. He made up mind about me, took me home. My only complaint about Japanese hospitality is those chin-high baths are too bleeding hot. But turned out I was not jeopardized. Mama-san was as skilled at makeup as Sidrus. My social arm is very convincing, and a kimono covered its seam. Met 4 cells in 2 days, as Comrade Bork, and wearing makeup and kimono and tabi, and if a spy was among them, don't think he could identify Manuel O'Kelly. I had gone there intensely briefed, endless figures and projections, and talked about just one thing, famine in 82, 6 years away. You people are lucky, won't be hit so soon, but now with New Tube, you're going to see more and more of your people turning to wheat and rice, and shipping it to Catapult Head. Your time will come. They were impressed. Old organization, as I saw it, and from what I heard, relied on oratory, whoop-it-up music, and emotion, much like church. I simply said, "There it is, comrades. Check those figures. I'll leave them with you." Met one comrade separately. A Chinese engineer given a good look at anything can figure a way to make it. Asked this one if he had ever seen a laser gun small enough to carry, like a rifle. He had not. Mentioned that passport system made it difficult to smuggle these days. He said thoughtfully that jewels ought not to be hard, and he would be in Luna City next week to see his cousin. I said Uncle Adam would be pleased to hear from him. All in all, was productive trip. On way back I stopped in Novilin to check an old-fashioned punch tape foreman I had overhauled earlier. I had lunch afterwards, ran into my father. He and I were friendly, but didn't matter if we let a couple of years go by. We talked through a sandwich and beer, and as I got up he said, "Nice to see you, Manny. Free Luna." I echoed, too startled not to. My old man was as cynically non-political as you could find. If he would say that in public, campaign must be taking hold. So I arrived in El City cheered up, and not too tired, having napped from Torricelli. Took belt from Tube South, then dropped down and through Bottom Alley, avoiding Causeway crowd and heading home. Went to Judge Brody's courtroom as I came to it, meaning to say hello. Brody is old friend, and we have amputation in common. After he lost a leg, he set up as a judge, and was quite successful. Was not another judge in El City at that time who did not have side business, at least make book or sell insurance. If two people brought the quarrel to Brody, and he could not get them to agree that his settlement was just, he would return fees and, if they fought, referee their duel without charging, and still be trying to persuade them not to use knives right up to squaring off. He wasn't in his courtroom, though plug hat was on desk. Started to leave, only to be checked by group coming in. Still Yagi types. A girl was with him, and an older man hustled by them. He was mussed, and clothing had that vague something that says, "Tourist." We used to get tourists even then. Not hordes, but quite a few. They would come up from Earth, stop in a hotel for a week, go back in same ship, or perhaps stop over for next ship. Most of them spent their time gambling after a day or two of sightseeing, including that silly walk up on surface every tourist makes. Most loonies ignore them, and granted them their foibles. One lad, oldest, about 18 and leader, said to me,
"Where's Judge?"
"Don't know, not here." He chewed lip, looked baffled. I said, "What trouble?" He said soberly,
"Going to eliminate this tomb, but want Judge to confirm it."
I said, "Cover tap rooms around here. Probably find him." A boy about 14 spoke up.
"Say, aren't you Gospodino Kelly?"
"Right."
"Why don't you judge it?"
Oldest looked relieved.
"Will you, Gospodin?"
I hesitated. Sure, I've gone judge at times, who hasn't? But don't hanker for responsibility. However, it troubled me to hear young people talk about eliminating a tourist. Bound to cause talk. Decided to do it. So I said to tourist, "Will you accept me as your judge?" He looked surprised. "I have a choice in the matter?" I said patiently, "Of course. Can't expect me to listen if you're unwilling to accept my judging. But not urging you. Your life, not mine." He looked very surprised, but not afraid. His eyes lit up.
"My life? Did you say?"
"Apparently. You heard lads say that they intend to eliminate you. You may prefer to wait for Judge Brody." He didn't hesitate, smiled and said, "I accept you as my judge, sir." "As you wish." I looked at oldest lad. "What parties to quarrel? Just you and your young friend?"
"Oh no, Judge, all of us."
"Not your judge yet." I looked around. "Do you all ask me to judge?" One nods. None said no. Leader turned to girl, added, "Better speak up, Tish. You accept Judge O'Kelly?"
"What? Oh, sure."
She was a vapid little thing. Vacantly pretty. Curvy. Perhaps 14. Slot machine type. And how she might wind up. Sorta prefers being queen over pack of Stilyagi to solid marriage. I don't blame Stilyagi. They chase around corridors because not enough females. Work all day and nothing to go home to at night. "Okay, court has been accepted and all are bound to abide by my verdict. Let's settle fees. How high can you boys go? Please understand I'm not going to judge an elimination for dimes. So ante up or I turn him loose." Leader blinked. They went into huddle. Shortly he turned and said, "We don't have much. Will you do it for 5 Kong dollars apiece?" 6 of them. "No, I'd not to ask a court to judge elimination at that price." They huddled again.
$50, Judge?"
"60. 10 each. And another 10 from you, Tish," I said to girl. She looked surprised, indignant. "Come, come," I said. "Tanstaffel." She blinked and reached in the pouch. She had money. Types like that always have. I collected $70, laid it on desk, and said to tourist, "Can match it?" "Beg pardon? Kids are paying $70 Hong Kong for judgment. You should match it. If you can't, open pouch and prove it, and can owe it to me. But that's your share." I added, "Cheap for a capital case. The kids can't pay much, so you get a bargain."
"I see. I believe I see."
He matched with 70 Hong Kong. "Thank you," I said. "Now, does either side want a jury?" Girl's eyes lit up.
"Sure. Let's do it right."
Earthworm said, "Under the circumstances, perhaps I need one." "Can have it," I assured. "Want a counsel?"
"Why, I suppose I need a lawyer, too?"
I said counsel, not lawyer. Aren't any lawyers here?
Again, he seemed delighted.
I suppose counsel, if I elected to have one, would be of the same informal quality as the rest of these proceedings?
Maybe, maybe not. I'm an informal sort of judge, that's all. Sit yourself.
I think I rely on your informality, Your Honor.
Oldest lad said, this jury, you pick up chit, or do we?
I pay. I agree to judge for 140 gross.
Haven't you been in court before?
But not going to kill my net for extra I could do without. 6 jurymen, $5 each. See who's in alley.
One boy stepped out and shouted, Jury work! $5 job!
They rounded up 6 men, and were what you would expect in Bottom Alley. Didn't worry me, as I had no intention of paying mine to them. If you go judge, better in good neighborhood with chance of getting solid citizens. I went behind desk, sat down, put on Brody's plug hat. Wondered where he had found it.
Probably a cast-off from some lodge.
Court's in session, I said. Let's have names and tell me beef.
Oldest lad was named Slim Lemke. Girl was Patricia Carmen Zukov. Don't remember others.
Tourist stepped up, reached into pouch, and said,
My card, sir.
I still have it. It read, Stuart René Lejoie, poet, traveler, soldier of fortune.
Beef was tragically ridiculous. Fine example of why tourists should not wander around without guides.
Sure, guides bleed them white, but isn't that what a tourist is for?
This one almost lost life from lack of guidance. Had wandered into a tap room, which let Steel Yagi hang out. A sort of, club room. This simple female had flirted with him. Boys had let matter be, as of course they had to as long as she invited it. But at some point she had laughed, and let him have a fist in ribs. He had taken it as casually as a loony would, but had answered in distinctively earthworm manner, slipped arm around waist, and pulled her to him, apparently tried to kiss her. Now, believe me, in North America this wouldn't matter. I've seen things much like it. But of course Tish was astonished, perhaps frightened. She screamed. A pack of boys set upon him and roughed him up, then decided he had to pay for his crime, but do it correctly. Find a judge. Most likely they chickened. Chances are not one had ever dealt with an elimination. But their lady had been insulted. Had to be done. I questioned them, especially Tish, and decided I had it straight. Then said, Let me sum up. Here we have a stranger. Doesn't know our ways. He offended, he's guilty. But meant no offense, far as I can see. What does jury say? Hey, you there. Wake up. What do you say?
Juryman looked up blearily, said, Eliminate him.
Very well. And you?
Well...
Next one hesitated.
Guess it would be enough just to... Beat tar out of him, so he'll know better next time. Can't have men pawn women. Her place will get to be as bad as they say Tara is.
Sensible, I agreed. And you? Only one juror voted for elimination. Others ranged from a beating to very high fines. What do you think, Slim?
Well,
he was worried. Face in front of gang, face in front of what might be his girl, but had cooled down and didn't want Chum eliminated.
We already worked him over. Maybe if he got down on hands and knees and kissed floor in front of Tish and said he was sorry?
Will you do that, Gospodine Lajoie?
If you so rule, Your Honor.
I don't. Here's my verdict. First, the juryman, you are fined. Fee paid because you fell asleep while supposed to be judging. Grab him, boys. Take it away from him and throw him out.
They did, enthusiastically. Made up a little for greater excitement they had thought of, but really could not stomach.
Now, Gospodine Lejoie, You are fined 50 Hong Kong for not having common sense to learn local customs before stirring around. Ante up.
I collected it.
Now, you boys line up. You are fined $5 apiece for not exercising good judgment in dealing with a person you knew as a stranger and not used to our ways. Stopping him from touching Tish, that's fine. Rough him, that's okay too. He'll learn faster. I could have tossed him out. But talking about eliminating for what was honest mistake, well, it's out of proportion. $5 each. Ante up.
Slim gulped.
Judge, I don't think we have that much left. At least I don't.
I thought that might be. You have a week to pay, or I post your names in Old Dome. Know where Bonton Beauté Shop is? Near Eastman Lock 13? My wife runs it. Pay her. Court's out. Slim, don't go away. No you, Tish. Gospodine Lajoie. Let's take these young people up and buy them a cold drink and get better acquainted. Again his eyes filled with odd delight that reminded of Prof. A charming idea, Judge. I am no longer Judge. It's up a couple of ramps, so I suggest you offer Tish your arm. He bowed and said, Malady, may I? And crooked his elbow to her. Tish at once became very grown up.
Спасибо, господин. I am pleased.
Took them to expensive place, one where their wild clothes and excessive makeup looked out of place. They were edgy. But I tried to make them feel easy, and Stuart Lajoie tried even harder, unsuccessfully. Got their addresses as well as names. Weil had one sequence, which was concentrating on Stilyagi. Presently they finished their coolers, stood up, thanked, and left. Lajoie and I stayed on. Gospodine, he said presently. You used another word earlier. To me, I mean. Call me Manny, now that kids are gone. What word? It was when you insisted that the young lady, Tish, that Tish must pay to, Tonstaffel, or something like that? Oh, Tonstaffel, means there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. And isn't, I added, pointing to a free lunch sign across room. Or these drinks would cost half as much. Was reminding her that anything free costs twice as much in long run, or turns out worthless. An interesting philosophy. Not philosophy, fact. One way or other, what you get, you pay for. I fanned air. Was Earthside once, and heard expression, free as air. This air isn't free. You pay for every breath. Really? No one has asked me to pay to breathe. He smiled. Perhaps I should stop. Can happen. You almost breathe a vacuum tonight. But nobody asks you because you've paid. For you, it's part of a round-trip ticket. For me, it's a quarterly charge. I started to tell how my family buys and sells air to community co-op. Decided it was too complicated. But we both pay. Lajoie looked thoughtfully pleased. Yes, I see the economic necessity. It's simply new to me. Tell me, Manny, and I'm called Stu. Was that really in danger of breathing vacuum? Should have charged you more. Please? You aren't convinced. But charge kids all they could scrape up, and find them too, to make them think. Couldn't charge you more than them. Should have. You think it was all a joke. Believe me, sir, I did not think it was a joke. I just have trouble grasping that your local laws permit a man to be put to death so casually and for so trivial an offense. I sighed. What do you start explaining when a man's words show there isn't anything he understands about subject? Instead is loaded with preconceptions that don't fit facts and doesn't even know he has. Stu, I said, let's take that piece at a time. Are no local laws, so you couldn't be put to death under them. Your offense was not trivial,
I simply made allowance for ignorance, and wasn't done casually, or boys would have dragged you to nearest lock at zero pressure, shoved you in, and cycled. Instead, were most formal, good boys, and paid own cash to give you a trial, and didn't grumble when verdict wasn't even close to what they asked. Now, anything still not clear? He grinned, and turned out to have dimples like proof. Found myself liking him still more. All of it, I'm afraid. I seem to have wandered into looking-glass land. Expected that. Having been Earthside, I know how their minds work. Some. An Earthworm expects to find a law, a printed law for every circumstance. Even have laws for private matters such as contracts. Really? If a man's word isn't any good, who would contract with him? Doesn't he have reputation? We don't have laws, I said. Never been allowed to. Have customs, but aren't written and aren't enforced. Or could say they are self-enforcing because are simply way things have to be, conditions being what they are. Could say our customs are natural laws because are way people have to behave to stay alive. When you made a pass at Tish, you were violating a natural law, and almost caused you to breathe vacuum. He blinked thoughtfully. Would you explain the natural law I violated? I had better understand it, or best I return to my ship and stay inboard until lift, to stay alive. Certainly. It's so simple that once you understand, you'll never be in danger from it again. Here we are, 2 million males, less than 1 million females. A physical fact, basic as rock or vacuum. Then add idea of Tarnstaffel. When thing is scarce, price goes up. Women are scarce. Aren't enough to go around. That makes them most valuable thing in Luna. More precious than ice or air. As men without women don't care whether they stay alive or not. Except a cyborg, if you regard him as a man, which I don't. I went on. So what happens? And mind you, things were even worse when this custom or natural law first showed itself back in 20th century. Ratio was 10-1, or worse, then. One thing is what always happens in prison. Men turn to other men. That helps not much. Problem still is because most men want women, and won't settle for substitute, while chance of getting true guilt. They get so anxious they will kill for it. And from stories old-timers tell, was killing enough to chill your teeth in those days. But after a while, those still alive found a way to get along. Things shake down. As automatic as gravitation. Those who adjust to facts stay alive. Those who don't are dead, and no problem. What that means, here and now, is that women are scarce and call tune, and you are surrounded by 2 million men who see to it you dance to that tune. You have no choice. She has all choice. She can hit you so hard it draws blood. You doesn't lay a finger on her. Look, you put an arm around Tish, maybe try to kiss. Suppose instead she had gone to the hotel room with you. What would happen?
Oh, heavens. I suppose they would have torn me to pieces.
They would have done nothing. Shrugged and pretended not to see. Because choice is hers, not yours, not theirs. Exclusively hers. Oh, be risky to ask her to go to the hotel. She might take offense, and that would give boys license to rough you up. But, well, take this Tish. A silly little tart. If you had flashed as much money as I saw in your pouch, she might have taken into head that a bundle with tourists was just about what she needed, and suggested it herself. In which case, would have been utterly safe.
Lejoie shivered.
At her age? It scares me to think of it. She's below the age of consent, statutory rape.
Oh, bloody. No such thing. Women her age are married, or ought to be. Stu is no rape in Luna. None. Men won't permit. If rape had been involved, they wouldn't have bothered to find the judge, and all men in earshot would have scrambled to help. But chance that a girl that big is virgin is negligible. When they're little, their mothers watch over them, with help from everybody in city. Children are safe here, but when they reach husband high, he's not holding them, and mothers quit trying. If they choose to run corridors and have fun, can't stop them. Once a girl is nubile, she's her own boss. You married? No.